Accession number 3765, Reel 2.
So Arthur Harris, Reel 2. Yes, so what happened?
Oh, I remember now the name of the fort that was besieged was Warna, W-A-N-A. And when the British political officer got back to Tonk and began to go through the pile of despairing messages, which were more and more despairing as he got to the end, the last message, I was told, read from his Indian assistant inside the fort, "Tomorrow my throat will be cut. I do not wish Indian government to sympathize with my family." Gave us a bit of a smirk, because we realized that's about all the sympathy you'd get from the Indian government. So we went out and we shot up the one or two small concentrations of these fellows who were surrounding the fort. They were a very half-hearted bunch. They cleared off. Finally we landed alongside the fort, taking the British political officer with us, who had a large bag of rupees with which to recompense those that had been loyal and ostentatiously to deny any to those who were under suspicion. He held a jirga, as they call it, a discussion, and then we all went home. That was my last experience in India, because I was then posted to Baghdad.
Did you get any impression that the government of India was rather reluctant to let the Air Force do too much?
I wouldn't say the government of India were, but I think the army was rather upset that, as they always apparently expected to have a little war or two on the frontier every season, and a KCB or two, that we were rather sticking a spoke in their wheel. That's the impression we got.
In 1922, then, you were posted to Iraq to take command of 45 Squadron. What was the actual function of that squadron in Iraq?
Well, it was equipped with Vernon aircraft, which was a big machine for those days, with a big fat cabin, described as a troop carrier. Well, it could carry for a reasonable distance about 8 fully armed troops with their equipment, and of course the 2 pilots and a fitter belonging to the airplane. Well, it didn't seem to me that they were a very valuable contribution to the problem of controlling the country in that guise. So, drawing a bow at a venture, I cut a hole in the nose, fitted them with a bomb sight, fitted the machine with bomb racks, for which we had to make quite a few of the pieces ourselves, because they weren't sufficient number of marked. And I got the squadron on the bombing, and they became very quickly the top bombing squadron in the country. And they were much more use as that, of course, than as merely carrying a few half a dozen flat-footed infantrymen or beer for them around the countryside. We helped the army out on one occasion, I remember, by evacuating dozens of dysentery cases from an army battalion that had been drinking the beautiful clear stream water in Kurdistan. Well, as the beautiful clear streams are always used by the locals for the same purpose as we use toilet paper, naturally enough, they all got dysentery. And we had to cart them by the dozen back to Baghdad into hospital. And the next excitement we had was the Turkish attempt to take back from Iraq the Mosul Vilayet, the whole area around Mosul, including the city. Well, by then we had only Assyrian levies as troops. Very fine fellows they were too. And not many of them. However, the Turks apparently were under the impression that we were all sick of war and that England would never really do much to stop them. However, when we went bombing them, as soon as they came over the frontier, and they in addition ran into the levies, they had another thought and they went back home again. So that put a stop to that. Then I got the squadron on to night flying. And we had one or two minor local troubles with other tribes, but we found a few threats, followed if necessary by a few small bombs, would bring them immediately to heel.
What sort of accuracy were you able to achieve in bombing in these early days in India and Iraq?
We reckoned to get a dozen bombs within certainly 25 yards of the center of a circle. That's on a target in flat country in daylight. Of course, it's a different thing altogether when you're bombing in mountainous country, where you don't know whether the bomb is going to hit the earth 600 feet up or 600 feet down. But it was more the deterrent moral effect. I don't think we inflicted very many casualties. I hope we didn't. But the fact remains that the tribesmen really gave up arguing with the local central government because of the threat of air attack if they didn't behave themselves. So while I was there, they very quickly came to heel and did behave themselves. I stayed, far as I remember, for about a couple of years.
What form did the training in night flying that you did, what form did that take? Was it navigation by night that you were practicing, or just the flying itself?
Well, flying, and after that, navigation as well. Then one or two of us used to fly, for instance, from a place like Kirkuk or Mosul back to Baghdad in the dark, just for fun. And as I'd been training night pilots all the time, so to speak, during the First War, or most of the time, I found a very interesting job.
Was night flying, in fact, a difficult matter?
Not now, but you see, in those days, we had no navigational equipment beyond a compass. We didn't even have direction finding. We had no artificial horizon. We had no automatic controls. So if you got into zero visibility, such as clouds or even dust haze, and in a hot country it's always very murky for the first 2,000 feet. Then you get above the daylight heat haze, which is lying on the ground, and you're all right. But you can get into trouble without artificial horizons to go by in a country where we were stationed, 9 miles outside Baghdad. You very often took off into complete darkness without so much as a light on the ground to show you where the ground was. I must say I surprised myself once or twice with that, so I used to send a few lights out for a mile or two in the direction of takeoff, so the fellas could get their levels correct before they got into the haze. But it was all good fun.
Were there any accidents at all?
No. Far from it. None that I recall night flying. We used to have occasional forced landings from engine failure. But I don't recall a single machine being written off. Just before I got to the squadron, they had had one fatal crash in which a particular friend of mine, a first pilot, had been killed. At least he died from the effects a day or two later. But while I was there, we had no fatal accidents, except for one pilot. We had a Bristol fighter in the squadron just to let us keep our hand in on something smaller than these big buses. And one fella playing around in a Bristol fighter killed himself. But I can't remember his name now, but he was a new boy, he'd just arrived, and he said he'd been flying Bristol fighters a lot. Could he try it? And that was that. But that was the only fatality in 2.5 years.
How did living conditions in Iraq compare with those in India?
Nothing like as good, because although, thanks to my senior flight commander, Thornby, we had the best mess of any squadron, the basic materials were pretty appalling. I mean, the so-called lamb was as often as not billy goat, and the so-called beef, if any ever appeared, was off the humpy cattle, which are more or less skin and bone. When you saw them, they had nothing to graze on. And when one got good things like melons, the medicos were in the habit of putting an interdict on them because they were frightened of cholera. However, when you're young and I've got plenty of work to do, those sort of things don't worry one a lot. I would say that the fellas in 45 Scotland enjoyed their stay out there, of course, separated from one's family. It was a bit of a trial. There's no such thing as giving you leave and paying your passage like there was later on. We went out there for 2 years solid, and that was that.
When you returned to England, you then went on a course at Sheerness, which was officially called the Senior Army Officers Course, but you're known by a rather different nickname.
Senior Officers Course, yes. Very informative, a very good course too, a lot of very good fellows on it. And then I went from there to 58 Squadron, which again was a night flying heavy bomber Virginia Squadron at Worthydown, where yet again I was employed in training people to night fly.
Was that because you yourself were particularly keen on night training, or was that part of the pursuit?
No, I'd been so much on night flying that I think whenever they saw my name coming up for a posting, they looked around for somewhere where there was night flying to be done.
Were you also able to do any night bombing practice when you were doing the night training?
No. Very little. Very little. We'd, the only place we could drop bombs would be small practice bombs on the circle in the middle of the airfield. But as we were bound on one side by a main railway line and the other side by a main road, it was a little bit of a tricky job. Once a year we went down to a camp in Western Zeeland, near Glastonbury, I think, Somerset, for bombing practice. But I don't recall we did any night bombing there. In fact, I don't think we really had by then any night bombing equipment. You see, in Mespot, we really made our own equipment. We manufactured our own marker bombs by merely using an unfused 20-pound bomb and fixing a white very light into the veins of the bomb so that when the bomb hit, the white very light would hit a striker and put up a white flare. You could see then, by the trace of smoke from the white flare, exactly where the bomb had landed. That was the first of the marker bombs. And though I said it shouldn't, entirely invented by me.
Did you in fact have difficulty obtaining ranges for bombing practice in the 1920s and 30s?
In this country, yes. Very much so. Just as they are today, having trouble to find anywhere to locate these big American refueling in the air machines. In this country, everybody has a reason for not having an aeroplane, or its droppings and leavings anywhere near them in particular. I remember at one time we had a long struggle trying to get Holy Island, but it was off the mainland as a bombing range. But apparently it was decided that the spirits of our ancestors had priority to the emergencies of the occasion.
Given the European situation in the mid-1920s, was there any difficulty in, as a squadron leader, instilling a sense of urgency into your training program at that time?
No, I wouldn't say so. The fellows thoroughly enjoyed themselves. They liked flying. They liked the communal life in the mess. The messing was reasonably good. We were beginning to get married quarters. Instead of having to live miles away and bear the expense of getting to work and back every day oneself. Which was the old order of things. In fact, I always said in those days the Air Force existed on the officers' personal transport, which he paid for himself.
Did you have, you had a car, did you?
Yes, I had not an official car. I had an official, yes, I'm wrong, I had an official car, but you couldn't use that to go to and from your home. Absolutely forbidden. You could use it on official duties only, like going to headquarters.
Were there any other squadrons with you based at Worthy Down besides your own?
Well, before I left, a 2nd Virginia squadron came down from Norfolk. It was a 7th squadron, as far as I remember, commanded by Portal. And, but as far as I recall, we were only together for a very short time there.
Was there a lot of rivalry between the two squadrons?
Oh, I think so, yes. We're all trying to do our best with what we'd got to do it with. But I was then posted to Camberley Staff College, the Army Staff College.
There was one incident you mentioned talking of the equipment that you had. There was one incident you mentioned last time where complaining about something brought you up in front of Trenchard. Can you tell me about that particular episode?
Well, yes, there's a piece of electrical equipment known as a voltage control. The electrics on the old Virginia, the nose types, were generated by a little dynamo worked by a windmill, a propeller. Well, we had one each side of the nacelle out and stuck on the bottom plane out there. And we fixed it so as we had one not working and just used the first one until that blew up, and then we had a second one to get home on. But the major trouble was the voltage control. It was always giving trouble. And I complained and complained and complained, and nothing was done about it. And finally, a very angry official appeared from Farnborough, having been disturbed, literally. And he said he'd come to see what was the matter with the voltage control. And I said, well, I have a pretty knowledgeable, from the electrical point of view, friend who's told me that the design itself is gimcrack, and that is why it's always failing. Well, as the design was from the Royal Aircraft Factory, where this fellow came from, he was rather upset. However, I drew him out a brand new one in a box from the stores, and I put him in my machine. I'd had the old one ripped out. It was in the front seat, I remember. I said, now you install that yourself, take it out of the box, you install it and adjust it, and we'll see what happens. And it worked perfectly, absolutely perfectly. And off he went, full of, you know, self-satisfaction or anything like that. And then I was sent for to report to the chief of the Air Staff, O'Boom. And as I went into his office, I met John Salmon. Oh, and he said, if you're for the high jump, come and see me, I'll rescue you. So I went in and booming away. You're always complaining about this electrical equipment, etc., etc., etc. And now a Farnborough man said that he put one in your machine, which was completely out of adjustment. He adjusted it himself and it worked perfectly. And that the fault is due to your people not being able to, not understanding their jobs or not doing them properly. And I said, yes, sir, that's quite true up to a point, but I would like to point out, I took that same machine up the same night on night flying, and the voltage regulator not only failed before I'd been a quarter of an hour in the air, but it also burst into flames. And that delighted the old boy. He really was. He absolutely delighted. So I didn't have any more trouble over that.
What impressions do you have of Trenchard personally and as a leader of the
Well,
RAF
I very
at that
seldom
time?
Met him, of course, in my humble rank. Very seldom. But or when one did meet him, one found it very difficult to understand what he was saying, because he had a rather jumbled, incomprehensible, booming way of talking, and his writing was almost entirely illegible. So it was rather hard to get a very quick impression. However, it was always fully understood throughout the Air Force that he was the boss, and he was saving the Air Force the whole time from being torn to pieces by the Navy and the Army, which would have been a major disaster had they succeeded.
Let's go on now then to your period at the Army Staff College at Camberley, which 2 years, 1928 to 1930. What opinion did you form during those 2 years, and also during the Senior Army Officers course at Sheerness, what opinion did you form of the state of the British Army at that time and its readiness for a modern war?
Well, I was very impressed with the keenness and the hard-working spirit of the Army officers individually, and also not only the students on the course, but the instructors as well. And I always thought the best instructor there, when I was there, was Monty. But I was rather staggered at the way they more or less ignored the Air Force. And particularly the Navy people there. There were a couple of naval fellows there. And my subsequent experience vis-à-vis the Navy, and I had very good friends working with them, but still, they just wouldn't listen, that they wouldn't believe, they wouldn't agree that the air could interfere with a battleship. Not even when General Mitchell of the U.S. Army Air Force sank the Ostfriesland, the German battlecruiser, as he said he could do, as a demonstration. All they did was to fire him. They reinstated him after he was dead, but that wasn't much use to him. But the whole attitude was, couldn't take the...